end of the last tape, I was talking about the fellow that had disappeared, and we didn't know what happened to him. We later found out he had been a wetback into Mexico, and that is, he went into Mexico illegally and disappeared down there, and never did know exactly what did happen to him after that. That is, for sure, we never learned what happened to him. There was a rumor floated around that his father had gone into Mexico. When he'd come down and got all of his belongings, he'd left in his room when he disappeared. And the rumor was that he went on into Mexico and picked him up and brought him back to the United States and committed him to a mental institution. But we never had confirmation of that from any source, reliable source. So we're not sure what happened to him. Late in October of 1941, we started a project of building a new house. That's the first house that we had ever considered owning. We thought probably we were going to be in Falfurrias a good long enough time to build a house and own the thing. So we got started, started building, and sometime in November, after we'd got all the paperwork for a mortgage and all that kind of stuff fixed up and closed out, work started to building the house, and they got the land cleared off, and the foundation piers poured, and was just about ready to start building the frame of the house when Pearl Harbor hit on December the 7th and closed everything down the way of building for a while. Finally, the lumber yard that was building it assured the War Production Board that had been set up that they had all the stuff necessary to complete the house, and there wouldn't be anything bad about it for the war effort. So they went ahead and completed the house, and we moved into it on around July the 1st, 1942. We moved into our house, except that it was mortgaged. The whole house cost us, we had put we had bought the land outright. We owned it, and we had put $300 down on the house. The mortgage was amounted to $3,200, and it was a two-bedroom, one-bath house with a living room and a dining room combined, and a kitchen attached, one-car garage, and a washroom. We got for, with including the land, cost us just about $3,750, which seems fantastic at the present time for such a house to be built at such a price. Another thing about that mortgage that seems kind of fantastic at the present time is that the mortgage was for 25 years at 4% interest, which 4% interest on the unpaid balance, which sounds like a dream at the present days when mortgages are only made for about 15 years and at anywhere from 11 to 15% interest. Middle of August of 41, Dot had gone to Oklahoma to her brother's wedding and had picked up Patricia Ann, who had been staying with my folks the winter before going to school in Woodward, Oklahoma. And so she brought her back and to start school in Valparaiso. And I think it was October the 10th, they told me at the plant my wife was wanting to talk to me. I got on the phone and I could tell there was something pretty bad wrong. She was almost crying. Said Pat had woken up and wasn't able to get up and go to school. And she thought that she'd called the doctor and the doctor came down and he was pretty sure she had polio. Poliomyelitis, and then known too as infantile paralysis. It had affected her right leg, and it left it weak, and as she grew older, shorter than the other one, and she walked with a very decided limp. However, never heard much complaint out of her, because as she grew up, she saw other children that were so much better, worse off than she was with polio, that she didn't complain hardly any. And she had such a good outlook on life and so happy sounding all the time that she was well liked. In the eighth grade, she was declared the outstanding student as a exceptional citizen of the country by the American Legion post, which gave her also a big lift. She went through and after she completed college, got married, and a couple of years after the marriage, she had an operation on that leg, which almost made it equal to the other, the left leg. The only time you can notice now is when she gets somewhat tired, she begins to favor the right leg a little bit, and you'll notice that it is not as quite as, she doesn't get along quite as well on it as she does on the left one. During 1942, also, Dot had enrolled Donna in the Catholic school for beginners, and there she began to show that her spirit of independence, she didn't depend on anybody. If she wanted to do something, that she did it without supervision from anybody, hardly. without asking anybody. She was known as the independent person of Foul Furious. Early in 1944, the War Production Board ordered us to start increasing the size of our plant, or increasing the efficiency of our plant in the getting out the propane and butanes from the gas we were processing. Celanese Corporation of America was building a plant in Bishop, Texas, to make a product for synthetic rubber that is far superior to any of the synthetic rubbers at that time, and wanted to get that Celanese plant built, get it on production ability, making us rubber. However, by the time they got it going, they never made any of that stuff because the war was over, and other people had increased the efficiency of making synthetic rubber to the point where Celanese was behind time at that time. That's how fast things were moving in those days. Anyway, late in 44, we got started on the actual construction of the increasing the size and efficiency of our plant. Mr. Wilson and Mr. Will, the operating vice president of the company, came to me and says, we've got this new man down here now, a fellow named John Lynch, and said, I want you to work with him and figure out how we can best do this job without slowing down our what we are doing already. Continue to run about the same as we are running now, and get it to where with a very short shutdown, maybe of not over a week, we can change over and have the whole works running at full efficiency in very short order. So I went to work on figuring that out, and got it all figured out, and took it to John Lynch, and he went over, he says, I don't see a thing wrong with that. He says, it looks to me like that's going to be it. So he and I went to Mr. Wilson and Mr. Will and laid that schedule out, and how the stuff would have to come in and how we would do the job so that this other would happen just like we wanted to, and it was okay. Hudson Engineering was going to do the work, and they said they thought they could do it that way. It worked out quite well. In fact, I think we were only shut down 8 days when we changed over to do the whole work. There was one kind of funny thing happened on that. One of the first things they did was take out a regulator on our oil line that we hadn't been using. It was a superfluous regulator on the old plant. We'd never used hardly at all anyway. Did most of it hand control, which was okay. They'd taken that regulator out and moved it to another location and laid it down, and I says, I looked at the flow sheet, and I said, that regulator won't work there. Well, why won't it work there? Well, I can't put my finger on why it won't work, but it just won't work there. Well, you've got to come up with a better reason than that. So I went ahead and put that regulator in there, this spot. And so, actually, when we started up, we would start up and run for 2 or 3 days at half load. And getting out, finding the leaks and the other bugs, and we'd got the thing all worked out. So John Lynch says, are we ready to kick it in the pants and go full blast? I said, yep. He said, this happened to be Saturday morning, just before noon. He says, okay, get at it this afternoon and get her going. And so I got with the operator and we started it up and got up to just about full load. And here we begin to, our absorption oil begin to spray out over the cooling tower. So I shut back down and went back to the half load for a little while, and then we tried it again. The same thing happened. So I went out, sat down in the water barrel, and got me a drink of cold water, and I sat there and trying to figure why in the world that oil spilled out over the cooling tower, popped out over the cooling tower out of this one vessel. And so I sat there, and finally it came to me why it was that there was a pump between the tank that was trying to control the level in and that regulator. And this tank was had the pop valve on it. And when the level got low in that tank, the pump or the regulator shut off down the way, but the pump didn't know about that, so it tried to pump, kept pumping the same amount of oil out of the flash tank, and when it reached the pressure in the hot flash tank that it was going into, and couldn't get on past that for the regulator, well, it just popped out the pop valve. And that was the reason when this explanation came to me, why I immediately jumped up and started looking around to see who I could see. This was late Saturday evening by that time. And I saw John Lynch, our superintendent, driving by. I let out a squall and waved and hollered and got him stopped, told him what the deal was, that we couldn't go up to full speed because of the situation. And he says, well, holy mackerel, you sure? I said, yes. He says, let's try it again. So he come in and we tried it again, and the same thing happened. And I says to head operator, I says, you better go turn that oil in so it'll go into the tanks rather than up there. And he says, well, that'll get into the gasoline in the stock tank. And I says, well, it'll do a whole lot more good there than well on top of that cooling tower. Well, he says, you got a point. And then he went off to laugh and says, shut her down. So he shut back to half speed again. Then he says, now, what are we going to do? I said, well, we got to do something. I says, I think what the main thing we got to do is move that regulator valve back up here at the corner of this pump building before the hot flash tank. And he says, okay, let's do it then. Hudson Engineering was doing the contracting work, so he says, let's get a hold of John Baird, see if you can get a hold of him. So I put in a call, and they said he was at the down at the Rice Hotel in the Houston club room, and so I got him there, outlined the situation to him, and he says, holy mackerel, you're right as the rain, couldn't be any more righter. He says, get the Gully, that was the construction superintendent for Hudson, says, get him out there and get high behind, get that regulator moved. You're right, you've been telling us all along that that regulator wouldn't work at that place, but you didn't know why. Well, now we know why. Gully got there, John Lynch, Gully got together, they just figured out that they could have the thing ready again by 4 o'clock the morning. So John Lynch told me to get into the groove and get out, go in and go to bed. When I came back at 4 o'clock ready to start the thing up, so, because I had to shut the whole plant down and do this job, so I went home and went to bed. I got back out there at 4 o'clock, lacked about 30 minutes being ready to get started. Finished up getting the regulator mounted and everything, and we started the thing up, and it was run beautifully. By noon Sunday, I was running practically full speed and without any trouble at all, which made everybody happy. When we first started this unit up at half speed back under, there was an amusing thing happened, as it turned out. It could have been very serious otherwise. Again, we were starting up about 4 o'clock in the morning. This is in the summertime. It was just getting daylight when got out there and was getting things started. I had the instrument fella, head of our instrument department, come out to help me. So if something needs to be done in the way of instrumentation, he'd be there, and I wouldn't have to call him and wait on him. So as we got getting warmed up, this hot flash tank that had oil in it, usually at about 450 degrees, had a big hunk of mud up on the side of it. We hadn't got it insulated yet, and this big bunch of mud began to smoke. So I told Jim Young, this our instrument fellow, I told him to get a ladder and get up there and knock that mud off of there before it got cooked on so solid we couldn't get it off. So he got the ladder and he went up there and he hammered that mud off, and one big hunk of mud fell down, and I never saw a fella come down the ladder. I don't think he even touched the rungs. I think he just put his feet on the handrails and slid down. He says there's a connection up, 1-inch connection up there, pipe connection that has just got a tin thing in it to hold to keep mud out of that thing when they're shipping it, keeping the dirt and rain and water and stuff out of it. And it says it's just a little old hunk of tin. So I hollered at the shift foreman. I says, get her shut down in a hurry. So we shut things down pretty fast. If that piece of tin had blown out, that hot oil come right out of that connection, probably pretty fast, and blasted right over to the engine and to the pump room, and probably caught fire right immediately. But after it was all over with, it was kind of amusing that the way Jim Young came down that ladder and what he said. This all happened, of course, in April of 1945, and on as long towards the latter part of April. And on May the 8th, of course, the war in Europe was declared over, and Germany had surrendered unconditionally, and which made us very happy, except that it is still going on in over in the Pacific, which was taking lives, what we thought needlessly. Things rocked along smoothly on the starting of the plant, getting it running at full blast then, and we got the thing lined out in a few days. We started making various products to ship to the Celanese plant that was just about to get started over near Kingsville, and we didn't know how much longer it was going to last in Asia over in the Pacific with Japan. We figured it couldn't be too long because they were being driven back quite rapidly. We had a bunch of us talking at the plant one day, and I said, well, this is not quite ending like one in the story that Liberty Magazine printed before the war ever got started. And one difference there is that Russia was on Germany's side in the story, they're on our side here. Everything else is pretty near true to what the story was. And they ended it by the United States dropping an atomic, what they called then a U-235 bomb, out on the steppes of Russia, and they all surrendered right fast when they saw what that could do. Somebody said, well, they probably never have a bomb like that anyway. And that was too much to think about. And so on the morning of August the 5th, we woke up, headlines in the paper, Hiroshima, Japan, obliterated by atomic bomb. And said it estimated 140,000 people killed. I don't think that figure has ever been absolutely confirmed, but anyway, there was lots of people killed, and I told them if they didn't surrender immediately that they'd drop another one on Nagasaki 3 days later. And they didn't surrender immediately, and so they dropped the other on Nagasaki. But when they did, most of the people were out of there, and there wasn't a big casualty list, but the town of Nagasaki was obliterated, wiped off the map of Japan, and the next day Japan decided that the better part of valor was to call it quits, and they surrendered. Almost immediately, a great cry arose in the United States and other countries around the world that was using an atomic bomb was immoral, We shouldn't have done it, that is too much for one bomb to do. And what they call themselves, the anti-nukes, counter-nuclear people, that should have never been done in the first place. And they should have just gone ahead and invaded. In 1971, I was touring Japan. I was waiting in a railroad station for one of the bullet trains that we were going to ride on, and I was talking to our guide. He was a young Japanese, probably somewhere near 35 years old, and he could just barely remember the war, closing days of it particularly. I asked him what his generation in Japan thought about the war, and he said, well, most of them thought like the Emperor Hirohito did, they shouldn't have ever got into it in the first place. It shouldn't have never started. Japan shouldn't have never started it, that they was pretty near sure they couldn't be able to hold out and win it against the United States and Great Britain and Canada and Australia, a number of other people. So I says, well, what was your thinking, or what is your generation's thinking of the atomic bomb dropping? He says, Mr. Gibbons, he says, you know that if the United States and Great Britain had invaded Japan, thousands of Japanese lives and possibly thousands of American and British lives, Australian lives would have been lost, and many more lives have been lost than there was in the two droppings of the atomic bomb. And do you think for a moment that if Japan had had the atomic bomb and they could have dropped it on Los Angeles or New York City or Washington, D.C., any of those places, that they wouldn't have done it? He said, of course they would. He said, you only get into war for one purpose, and that's to win, whether you're were attacked or whether you're attacking. The only thing is to win, and if that was what it was going to take to win it fast, that's what would have happened if Japan had the atomic bomb. Of course, they didn't, and they weren't even close to having it. And the United States concentrated on all of our effort on it and put in billions of dollars and perfected the thing. Now have power plants running off nuclear power, and anti-nukes are still hollering. Still hollering this, the 28th day of August, 1980, saying nuclear power is immoral, unsafe, causes the whole nation probably to have cancer, and you don't know what they're claiming more things that you can even figure about. This summer has been a terrifically hot summer for some reason why we don't know for sure. We've had terrific heat and lots of people. Over 1,300 deaths has been attributed in the United States alone has been attributed to the heat. summer heat. One man, newsman, called or sent word to one movie actress that has died in the wool, anti-nuke, said there hadn't been confirmed one death from nuclear power generating electricity, but there has been 1,300 confirmed deaths from solar power this summer. That kind of calmed some of the anti-nukes down right for a little bit to back up and think about what they're going to, how they're going to say about that. The rest of 1945 year was sort of uneventful. After the war was all over, they had the peace signing and all of that, occupying part of Germany with our troops. Part of Japan was being occupied by the United States, Great Britain, and Australia, Australian troops. And not much of anything went on. Along in November of 45, Mr. Wilson, the principal owner of the company, the president, was down one day and got with John Lynch, that was then our superintendent, and they got me and wanted to know, I said, now you put in a hard 44 and you put in a 45 with no vacation. Of course, we don't want anybody to go on vacation after December the 1st. And so, what do you want? Do you want us to pay for your vacation, or what do you want to do about it? I said, well, if just soon as you, sometime in 46, I'd like to take a month. And he says, well, I don't see anything wrong with that. So you just schedule your month of vacation in 46 whenever you want to. So by the middle or long towards May of 1946, everything was running in good shape, no troubles, and we were proceeding with to make gasoline and other products as though it was never been anything but doing that. So I told them that I would schedule my month's vacation starting on August the 1st, which was going to be a Monday. And we took off on the morning of August the 1st, 1946, heading for Tulsa, Oklahoma, and took us a good part of 2 days to get there, as we weren't in any hurry. We spent 2 or 3 days around Tulsa, visiting Dot's mother and brothers and sisters that were living there. And then we went to Woodward, Oklahoma, where my folks were living, and spent a day or two there. I think we spent two full days there. And then we just took off going west, and northwest, actually. And we went to Denver, Colorado, visited some friends in Denver, over a night and a day, another night, left there very early in the morning, and made it to Salt Lake City that night. And spent the night in Salt Lake City, and proceeded on to Ely, Nevada the next day. That wasn't a very long trip, but we started in late and from Salt Lake City. We had stopped, spent a couple hours at the Great Salt Lake and let the kids swim, Great Salt Lake, and then proceeded leisurely on to Ely, Nevada, where we spent the night. Left there very early the next morning, and headed across on Nevada, rest of the way about across Nevada, down to the Carson City, the capital, and on into Yosemite National Park in California, going into it over the Cahokia Pass at 9,908 feet elevation, on through the park slowly, and got to a town in California late in the evening, and we could see we wasn't going to get to Oakland. This town was Oakwood, where we stopped. Spent the night because we didn't want to get into Oakland where Dot's sister lived, and we were headed late at night. Next morning we got up and proceeded on toward Oakland, arriving there shortly after noon. We didn't want to get there and have to have Dot's sister feed us at noon, so which she would insist on if we got there before noon. So it was 1:30 or so later, somewhere between 1:30 and 2 when we arrived in Oakland. Dot says they live on 49th is a street or place or avenue. Well, I don't know. I don't think there'd be a 49th Avenue and a 49th Street. Well, I don't know about Oakland. It'd be anything, I think. Anyway, we were driving on MacArthur Boulevard, which was the main street going through Oakland. And all at once I saw a sign that said 48th Street. So I watched very carefully, and the next one was 49th Street. I didn't know which way to turn for sure, but I turned to the left. And soon saw that was the 6,000 block, so I went down to 54 49th, and there wasn't anything there. So we proceeded on across a little bridge and stopped at a filling station and asked where we might find 49th Street. And the fellow said, well, there isn't any such place in this town. I said, well, what town is it? He said, well, it's Alameda. I said, where do we get into Alameda? He said, back there when you cross that little bridge. Well, I went back and went up to the sub-police station we'd seen, stopped in there and asked him if there was a 49th Street, the 49th place, or 49th Avenue in Oakland. The fellow says, not only a 49th Street,